Chapter 1.
It's only words, and words are all I have, etc.
It's only words, and words are all I have, etc. Take your heart away.
A birth, a bra, and a bloom.
I want to be the Pope. It was the 3rd of December, a day I'll always remember. Yes, I will. 'Cause that was the day. 9 years and 2 continents apart, a pair of rock and roll posers were born. Ozzy Osbourne posed while singing metal in the First World, and I posed as a rock drummer in the Third World. Ozzy also posed a fundamental rock and roll rebellion question via the lyrics of Geezer Butler, born a Catholic, in the Black Sabbath song After Forever, when he asked, "Would you like to see the Pope on the end of a rope? Do you think he's a fool?" If you were to ask me, born a Catholic, to describe myself in 3 words, using both the humility and razor-sharp wit that I have been blessed and cursed with, I would immediately answer, Danny DeVette. Then, "I'm just joking," followed by, "Only need 2. Then after a slight pause, which is necessary to set the punchline up, because Andy Warhol said timing is everything, I would proudly utter, "Well hung." However, despite my perpetual efforts at creating and sustaining false myths, the 2 words that actually describe me are wise and ass, not in singular form, but in combination. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am a wise ass. Often, I'm the only wise ass in the room or band, but shortly before the dawn of the new millennium, no, it's not a Spinal Tap lyric, I was blessed and cursed to be part of a rock and roll outfit in which every member was proud to be a wise ass. Sito, Martin, Wade and yours truly, under the guise of a band called Vonderboom, used our collective talent to charm people and wreak havoc for 13 years in the south of Africa. And get away with it. At the same time the first Vonderboom album came out, I released my version of a gospel album called Hypocrites Unite on the Trippy Grape record label of fellow wise-ass Dacha Dirk Ace, the founder of the alternative Afrikaans Voorvrij movement that launched the careers of Koos Kombuis and Johannes Kerkorrel and the Gereformeerde Blues Band. Dirk also bestowed major rock and roll rebel credibility on my son Luca by providing the house in which he was conceived. In keeping with things missionary and Catholic, my earliest childhood memory of a personal wise-ass manifestation is an incident that occurred while in grade 3 at St. Joseph's Convent, Germiston. My mother and father were both from the Johannesburg area and had relocated separately to Zimbabwe. After falling in love and making love at least 3 times, they came to be parents to Daniel, David and Anita in that order. Aware that Mom missed her family incredibly, and being the great husband he was, in the early 60s, my dad left his folks in Bulawayo and arranged a job transfer back to Johannesburg. Upon their return, Rudy and Olive De Wet rented a house in Primrose, directly opposite the convent. Sister Columbus was the class teacher in my 2nd year at the Dominican institution, and one morning, in line with the Catholic premise of "give me a child for the first 7 years and I'll give you a Catholic for life," St. Francis, methinks, she dutifully asked what we wanted to be when we grew up. A huge smile that just oozed validation surfaced when Sister Columbus heard the first little girl reply, "A nun, sister." After that, there were no more aspirant nurses or firemen forthcoming, only nuns and priests, except for me. Every exagitarian molecule in my body would make sure that I didn't stick to the game plan. So when my turn came, I said, "I want to be the Pope. Girls just want to have fun, playing drums in a padded bra." I never did achieve that aspiration and never got to meet a Pope or even attend a mass said by one. But I did get to play a whole lot of drums, including 3 shows wearing a padded bra, before I experienced a whole lot of Popes together in the flesh, on a stage in the UK. But more about British endeavours later. Many years after I started out as a drummer, it dawned on me that as rock evolved, something very unfair in terms of the dynamics within a band would manifest. Even if there was only one guitar player in a band, he was referred to as the lead guitarist. In AC/DC, it's clear-cut. Angus Young is the lead guitarist, and his brother Malcolm Young, rest in peace, played rhythm guitar. But Jimmy Page, the only guitarist in Led Zeppelin, was also called the lead guitarist. So, a few years into my tenure with Vonnebohm, though there was only one member plying his trade behind a drum kit, I made sure that Danny DeVette's role was that of lead drummer. So, with a lead drummer at its core, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Padded Bra Trilogy. Petit Cheval, the 80s band that I played with post-Evoid, was managed by Louis van Wyk for a good part of our short career. One of the other acts in his stable was a group he assembled to repeat a previous Spice Girls type idea of his. Louis had achieved success with the Working Girls, five gorgeous singer-dancers. He followed that by taking things up a notch with ladies who could actually play instruments. And to complete the politically correct theme, he named the outfit Chess. The group was fronted by his talented wife, the late Irene van Wyk, who went on to have a successful solo career in the Afrikaans market. Irene shared vocal duties with a very attractive African singer called Todd Twala, who had toured abroad as part of the Ipitombi Theatre production. Thelma Sigona on keyboards, together with Jean Chelyu on guitar, and Nikki Smart on keyboard bass, completed the female contingent of this prepackaged, multiracial, almost all-girl band. The initial Chess lineup included drummer Jared Aston, who had just left Teen Sensations Face to Face. He later went on to have a hit with My Kinda Girl as the frontman for Cinema, an act that also featured Chris Frank and Mike Todd. Today, Jared is a successful impresario, and I'm not sure why he left Chess. But his replacement was the sassy Penny Power, who had previously occupied the drum throne for punk hotties Peach, who boasted the powerhouse frontwoman Angie Peach. Sadly, Penny is no longer with us. In the mid-90s, Penny, Pangwula Bursis, was killed in a car accident in Pietermaritzburg. Shortly after one of the legendary Radio 5 Moni's Esprit tours during the mid-80s, I received a call from Louis asking if we could meet to discuss an urgent favour he needed from me. Penny was in hospital, and Chess needed a drummer to fill in for three gigs, two of which were for big shows, and he wasn't prepared to cancel. I was the first choice on the girls' list because I wore more makeup than them. Jokes aside, as Petit Cheval and Chess shared the same management, the two bands played many shows together. We were often on the same tours, had loads of fun, partied up a storm, and became friends. While I was flattered to be number one on the list and wanted to help Louis out, I was reluctant to oblige, feeling that doing so would result in me losing credibility with the Petit Cheval fan base. Our followers were into Simple Minds, U2 and Ice House, and Chess was a Bananarama Kajagoogoo type band. After explaining this to Louis, he appreciated my concern and came up with a way to pull this off in a win-win way. In exchange for a sizable amount of money, I would dye my hair blonde, dress in Penny's luminous clothes, and complete the outfit with pink lipstick, brightly painted nails, a bow in my hair, and a padded bra. I'm a whore, but I don't come cheap. That's exactly what Alex J., South Africa's coolest ever DJ TV presenter, said to Sito and I years later at the 94.7 Highveld Stereo Studios. It was a day we were laying down some radio spots to advertise an imminent Joburg Day concert that Vonnebohm was appearing at. Okay, this story isn't in the written book. I recorded an ad that went, "Hi, I'm not Craig from Watershed. I'm Danny from Vonnebohm, and you can join us both at Joburg Day." They actually aired that ad because Craig was gracious enough to go with it. Anyway, back to the story. We bumped into Alex, inquired what he was doing at the station at a time that wasn't anywhere near when his show aired, and his explanation that he had popped in to collect his profit share check ended with that memorable classic nine-word declaration. "I'm a whore, but I don't come cheap." A phrase that I instantly adopted and continue to use in appropriate or inappropriate circumstances. The Danny Becomes Penny incident was years before the Alex J revelation. But in that same spirit, I took the money, got any thoughts of moral guilt off my chest, and started to look for a bra that would be comfortable enough to both pose in, first priority, and drum in, second priority. Penny kindly loaned me her lipstick, and I hit the road as a part of the 3-gig, hopefully you can fool some of the people some of the time, world tour of the Witwatersrand. The show we did in the Indian suburb of Laudium was the smallest, and thanks to the political system of the day, wonderfully intriguing. It was my first Bollywood-type experience of how people from an Eastern culture party in a mega-friendly atmosphere, and it was a blast. The largest gig by far was an all-day festival at a stadium in Katlehong, where Chess was scheduled to play just before one of SA's most successful stars to date. Despite her untimely passing, the legend that remains Brenda Fassie. Accompanied by a sizable police escort, we entered the grounds to the sound of chanting and gunfire coming from the gates on the opposite side of the field. Chess completed our set to polite applause, left the stage relieved we'd done our thing, and along with the other 40,000 present, waited for Brenda to arrive. In the pre-internet and social media era, unscrupulous promoters were notorious for selling out a venue by advertising famous acts that were never even booked to perform, and then to disappear with the gate takings, leaving chaos behind. On several occasions, when the crowd realized it had been duped, they vented their frustration in the form of a riot. This was prevalent in rural areas, mainly, but city dwellers were well aware of these incidents. So as more time began to pass without the appearance of Miss Fozzie, the tension in the stadium began to rise to dangerous levels. The Tulani guards were the private security on the day, and those in front of the stage were equipped with shock sticks, which they would use when a concert goer acted overtly aggressive towards them. By doing so, everyone who witnessed such an action became even more angry, and I saw firsthand how easily a situation involving a huge mass of people confined to a limited space could ignite and result in a large-scale tragedy. The girls and I were nervously watching all of this go down, and as missiles started to land on the stage, Louis came up to me. He said the promoters had asked if I could please go back on and play a drum solo to entertain and calm the crowd until the headliner arrived. I asked them if they were fucking insane, adding that what the punters wanted to see on stage was South Africa's biggest African female star, not a white transvestite, no matter how sweet I was. It's just a jump to the left. Just then, a car screeched to a halt. We turned around and saw Brenda Fassie jump out while the vehicle was still moving. She had a really cool pair of leather pants on, and with bare feet she ran straight onto the stage, grabbed the mic and said, "Hey, Tula!" The angry mob was silenced in a split second. Miss Fassie then said, "Brenda thanks you!" The crowd roared in response, and having explained that her band were on the way and would arrive soon, she walked back to her Jaguar. After giving me the once over, she proclaimed that I was not Penny, but Danny from that other band, and beckoned me to join her in the back seat. As I climbed in, I greeted the driver, and she asked if I liked her manager's car, letting me know that she'd bought it for him as a gift. I answered in the affirmative, and when I complimented her on her pants, she bragged about how many dollars she'd paid for them, adding that she no longer bought clothes in Africa, but did all her garment shopping in New York. In terms of live concerts, many international superstars have delivered superb performances in our beloved country. Foo Fighters seriously rocked the FNB Stadium, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers were phenomenally good there too. But perhaps just a few notches down from the extraordinary show I saw them play at Hyde Park in London with guitarist John Frusciante. I enjoyed Bruce Springsteen as well, but as far as solo artists fronting a band go, the two best performers I've seen in South Africa were Rod Stewart at Sun City on the first tour and Brenda Fassie that afternoon. One of the biggest musical crimes committed by apartheid was that it robbed virtually all the white fans of the joy they could have experienced when witnessing our country's biggest stars in action. Brenda Fassie was such a superstar that, like James Brown, who coincidentally I was lucky to see at Hyde Park as a Chili Peppers special guest act, I couldn't believe it when he was standing right in front of me and he went, "I feel good." I was like, hey, that's that guy who's saying that. Like James Brown, Brenda had two bass players, one for the low grooves and another one to execute the funky slap bass parts. She also used Lazarus Kahuli to warm her band up for a few songs before she exploded, and I mean exploded, onto the stage. As opposed to the 600,000 sales she would achieve with her album releases, he was a Mickey Mouse urban artist, garnering a mere 70,000 sales per record. The final gig in my padded bra trilogy was where I had the most wazz-ass fun. Chess were booked to entertain the troops at an Air Force base in Pretoria, just like Spinal Tap. As per the norm, the drum podium was at the back of the stage, and thankfully, from their point of view, the girls had their backs to me and were oblivious to my antics. Louis also couldn't see me from his vantage point, and this was a good thing from the opposite perspective, because he would have encouraged me to take things even further. The airmen ogled us lustfully, and the rest of the band either dispassionately cruised above the glares by barely acknowledging them, or reacted in a friendly, bashful way. I, however, gave the audience exactly what they had hoped for by performing like a trailer trash horny porn star. I licked my lips, squeezed my tits together, adding more suggestive actions by the minute. Jaws dropped as I made eye contact with individuals while mouthing phrases like, "Fuck me, big boy, and I want to suck your cock." Seeing a band of popes because Bob thought he was going to meet Elvis. Okay, back to the "but I did get to experience a whole lot of popes in the flesh" bit, which actually came about via something unfortunate happening to my guru, a man whose lyrics have taught me way more than anyone linked to a religious order. I'm talking about Bob Dylan. In 1997, my second wife, the Irish descended one, Maura and I planned a trip to England and Ireland as a belated honeymoon. We had tickets for every UK show that Bob Dylan and Van Morrison, who were touring together on one bill, were playing that summer. It was to be the first time I was seeing either of them live, and I was lucky to be able to buy tickets through an industry connection a day before they went on sale to the general public. A week before we were due to leave, Bob Dylan went into hospital with histoplasmosis and was forced to cancel his appearances. Up to that point, it was only the second time he had done so for medical reasons. Thankfully, Uncle Bob survived what has been reported in some publications as a near-death experience. And once he was discharged, gave a typical wise-ass Dylan statement. "I thought I was going to meet Elvis." From my perspective, the Dylan-Morrison tour cancellation was like a death in the family, and friends and relations contacted me to commiserate. But we were committed to the trip and still had a blast, catching around 50 acts. I've seen Dylan 3 times since, but on that trip, we saw one of my top 10 favourite acts, The Levellers, at the Glastonbury Festival. Also experiencing a field of Brits celebrating their miffness in glorious fashion as Radiohead headlined the Saturday night. Our adventure kicked off at Finsbury Park at an Irish event called the Flaw Festival, where the lead singer from the Pogues stood in for Dylan. Incidentally, his band was called Shane McGowan and the Popes. In the year leading up to our honeymoon trip, 5FM were playing a song called Delirious by a new Irish singer-songwriter called Luca Bloom, who was also on the floor ball. Both of us were excited to see him live as we'd bought his album, loved it, and played it constantly. To get the best vantage spot, we arrived at the second stage marquee a good half an hour before he was due to appear, and were surprised to find just a handful of devotees there. In the discussions that followed, we learned that Luca was not really known in England, but had fans mainly in Canada and Ireland. I was proud to tell these diehard fans that they could add South Africa to the list. Luca Bloom performed solo that day, with an intensity that did justice to the incredible voice he has been blessed with. And by the end of the set, the tent was full of punters who had now arrived for the famous act up next. And we were all absolutely mesmerized. Before Luca's last song, he spoke about a recent treaty that had been signed in his homeland and said he was going to close with a very old song and a very new song that had been inspired by this event. The old song was, I presume, a traditional Gaelic lament that was incredibly sad, as it detailed the atrocities the English had committed to the Irish nation, including how the innocent, especially children, had suffered. He then segued into his new composition that consisted of poignant chords, but only one word: forgiveness. He sang the word over and over with more and more passion. This mantra brought both Maura and I, together with most of the people around us, to tears, and Mr. Bloom received the rapturous response he rightfully deserved. Keen to sustain the momentum, Suzanne Vega walked on immediately, gave Luca a hug, and launched into an a cappella version of Tom's Diner while her band picked up their instruments. I was waiting at the station, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. With the crowd still chanting the do-do-do-do part, her band kicked into the intro of her biggest hit, and she sang the first line. My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. With the crowd going ballistic and tears rolling down Maura's cheeks, she looked at me and said,
I never want to forget this moment. If ever we have a son, I want to call him Luca.